time of day changes, night, days, twilight,
right.
In going to, back to Chaucer with that great description
right.
of the sunset and it that ends with, and that was desired that it was nicht.
Right.
So that this use of, it's not called air there, it's called light and day,
right.
but the use of outside weather and outside
right.
time changes in this very self-conscious literary mode,
right.
is the air sort of an inheritor of that?
It is very much so. So in some ways, a lot of this is obviously not a new thing. We talked about this a little bit at Main Street, too, a way in which you know, there is sort of built into the word a sort of double reference,
yeah.
right? On one side toward the material world, or toward whatever it is we're breathing, but on the other side, toward affectation and toward artifice, right? You put on airs, whatever.
Yeah.
I mean, of course, it's almost kind of toggle switch moving back and forth between those. And then, because all that, I mean, if you go back to Aristotle's Meter and Logica, right? And this is the first thing he says, the first problem is what we call the air, right? And, you know, and he immediately understands, right, that describing whatever it is, right, that we're reading is bound up with, you know, the problem of human shape. Which, of course, is literally to take speech as the, you know, first way that human beings, you know, articulate knowledge. I mean, you're in the air doing that way. It's a, I mean, there's a constant kind of reciprocity that, you know, yeah, I mean, I'm not doing anything like making any sort of radical, huge claim about
it. But it's interesting that Priestley won't give that up.
No, he won't. And he realizes that it could count as a form of knowledge, right? I mean, it's not knowledge as it's sort of constructed, you know, traditionally. Because it has this sort of, I mean, it's like Milton would have loved this form of knowledge because it's acknowledging its own boundaries and its own reliance on communication. He's finding a way to do that. And I think that's really, it's right. And I think that is why one of the reasons he's sticking with air. That and also, you know, sort of that idea of, you know, what boiling down the word in the first place to sort of means. It's fine. But back to gases, and the other thing about that, it's actually a really funny story. Gas. There are different versions of what that word actually means, right? But basically, it's chaos and grief, right? And apparently, Van Helmont used that word to talk about gases, right? He was saying that it's chaos, right? And he was sort of misunderstood to say gas. I mean, like the air actually literally like mistranscribed what he was describing. See what I'm saying? I mean, it's a good. Jenny Uglow tells this story in her book on that.
So
there's this literal language. If you think of air as the transmitter of sound, right? There's this literal language. It's interfering. Saying, no, you're not going to call it gas. You're not going to call it chaos. You're not going to call me chaos. You know? So it's an interesting and sort of a flaky way of thinking about it. Here it is. Yes.
I'm interested in the idea that air could carry energies and disease,
yes,
like cholera,
yes,
was much believed to be carried by the air,
yes,
and also the fashion which comes up at the end of the 18th century, or believed in animal magnetism.
Yes,
could you talk about, you know, is there animal magnetism? Is there a special quality of the air which allows
right.
animal magnetism
to travel through it? Yeah, but which is a way to think about air as a kind of conductor, right? That's what you're talking about,
yeah.
Yeah, I mean, what you're really pointing, I mean, there is this whole long sort of tradition which really comes out of, you know, really thinking about the supernatural, right, as much as anything else. I mean, I would see that that's where some of those vocabularies are coming from. But there is also this sort of miasmatic kind of
thing. Is that the supernatural?
Right. I think it is derived from, you know, experiments with, you know, like second sight or apparitions sort of traveling through the air, moving from one person to the other, at least in some vocabularies. Of course, Newton is coming in, like the idea of ether, right, and really trying to sort of abstract that, you know, in some way, right, and even electricity, right, that there are these ways of sort of trying to strip, you know, that phenomenon of some of those associations. But it's still obviously out there, you know sort of popular culture.
That was terrific, and it sparked lots of things in my head. And one of the things I wanted to pursue a little bit more was the politics of air
right.
in this period. Priestley, of course, was at the very center of the dissenting community, teaching at Warrington Academy,
yes.
as where Marlborough knew him, of course,
yes.
And very caught up in the Jacobin
yes.
critique of the established government, and all your language of the common air,
yeah.
the Constitution.
Yes.
I kept thinking that for Priestley, this clearly has powerful political overtones.
And that's what Burke is trying to steal back.
Yeah, and then I was thinking back to Lord Mansfield, anti-slavery judgment,
yes.
the air of England is too pure for slaves to
yes.
breathe in. And,
right.
and clearly, yeah. Priestley is trying to sort of promulgate a notion of a purified democratic
yes.
air
yeah.
that's common to all.
Yeah.
That has to be preserved against the pollutions, infiltrations, plague.
Right.
I mean, what I was really interested in was the internationalism of
yes.
this experiment.
Yes.
That,
yes.
You know, whether you're in France or Germany, it doesn't matter.
It doesn't matter.
Or
maybe
the air has become
right.
cosmopolitan as
yes.
opposed to just English.
Right.
And I wonder if you thought about that.
I have thought about that. And you know, I mean, and you're pointing to something really, really important, you know, that's going on, you know, with Priestley. That's really, I mean, he's very aware of it. I think it's interesting that, I mean, there's this, one of the other things that's going on in this period is this kind of movement away from sort of climate theory and the idea that specific places may hold a whole democratic idea. The idea that specific places have their own air and that shapes the people. We all know that theory, right? But it is the idea that air is different from place to place, right? But once you break into theories, into Priestley's theory, you start to look, and this is why the chemical revolution is such a revolution, because, you know, the air isn't different in other places. Like, it might, at a particular moment, be influenced by different things, you know, but still, you have to find other ways to sort of define differences among places as opposed to the air. So there is this sort of, you know, attack, you know, superstitions of experience that's kind of implicit in that. But the other thing, I mean, you do get into some paradoxes here. Like, in the sort of, like, the air of England is too pure, it's really, you know, good example of that, that you have these kinds of radical kinds of Priestley's making too. But at the same time, you also have Priestley when you say, you know, well, English is the most virtuous language because it does have this sort of visibly particular form that shows that this is going on. And, you know, someone who actually didn't want to leave England and, you know, and who is very much working within that kind of linguistic medium and wanting to make particular roots for it. And there are sort of, you know, residual resistances. That the sort of universal idea was like he hated Lavoisier, you know that whole story, right? And you know, and really, despite the international community he was part of, you know, really had this very intense, very prevalent, he didn't like the idea. And one of the reasons he held on to deflogisticated air, right, was, you know, in this weird way, like, you know, this is the English cause, you know, against the French. So you also, I mean, Priestley's, like, the speech impediment is such a wonderful image of like these limitations within. This larger realm of possibility. And so I think there's a kind of critique. I mean, I don't want to paint too happy a picture of him, although I love him because in so many ways he is so much what we want someone to be, you know. So,
I mean, I just want to know why the English hierarchy is afraid of earphones.
Yeah. Well, because it makes this apparent, right? And it makes it, but when, the main thing is that really, and this I'll dig into, it's the image that I showed of the air pump, right, which is in the drawing room, right? And it's the idea is, I mean, air pumps were actually, like, toys, right? Things like anybody could buy an air pump, right? And you could have it in your living room. And then it would give you this knowledge that previously was, you know, really the province of human sort of scientific belief, that approach to the air. There were all kinds of, you know, provincial and you know, weather-based, you know, informal approaches to the weather that anybody, or air that anybody would. But the air pump is literally, and I didn't get into this at all, so I didn't think about it more as a metaphor for language, but literally, you know, if anybody can have an air pump, anybody can have knowledge of this medium, right? And it means that medium is common to everyone. And so, you know, and so a constitution that's invested in hierarchies of knowledge, and, you know, in any kind of class-based knowledge system, it's going to be an air pump. I think that's really what it's based on. And actually, I got the quote up short. He also says an air pump or an electrical machine, which is the other thing that you can also, you know, you can read one of, actually, Priestley's own history of the present state of electricity, or Franklin on electricity, and you could basically build your own electrical machine, or you could take the private heat out there. You could have, you know, what is, it's in the air, like it really does belong to everyone, and these machines make it. So I think that's really